Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. It is Wednesday, November 6th. Time to turn our attention toward topics that are pertinent to faithful family life. And today, this week, we're talking about youth. What does it mean to be a youth? What does it mean to be a youth in the church? What's important for them? And we've been talking about that the last couple of days, and I'm going to focus on it again today. The topic of youth groups. Are they good? Are they helpful? Or are they not doing what they set out to do? That's what we're going to get into here in just a little bit. As we talk with our guest today, we're going to talk with a DCE, a parish DCE, and campus pastor as well today. Looking forward to talking with them. If you'd like to join the conversation today, you can do so. 314-821-0850 here in St. Louis. Outside of St. Louis, 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email your questions and comments to family@kfuo.org. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, just go to our website, kfuo.org. Go to the sponsor section, look for the CUW logo, and click on that. That'll take you to their information, find out where they're located, not just in Wisconsin, but all over, actually, and all the great programs they have to offer. So go check it out, kfuo.org. Look for the sponsor section, click on the CUW logo. Joining us by phone today, we have two great guests, experts, when it comes to youth and nurturing them in the one true faith. Joining us by phone, campus pastor Marcus Zill from St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Laramie, Wyoming, and also coordinator for LCMSU. Good morning, Pastor Zill.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you with us on the phone today.
I heard you do the weather. You did the weather for Alexandria, Virginia. I thought you were going to do Laramie, Wyoming.
I couldn't get it open fast enough. I really tried.
I was going to be incredibly impressed. I'm wishing I was in Virginia.
I don't know. I don't know if the forecast sound any better. And also joining us by phone today, Jennifer Hills, Director of Youth and Christian Education at St. John's Lutheran Church in Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And it's pretty sad when the forecast in your area is the favorable one.
It's a beautiful day.
Looking like some rain tonight, but not too bad. Right now, 65, that does sound pretty nice. What's the temperature out there, Marcus?
Let's move on to the topic. No, we got a little snow on the ground. It got down to about 12 last night.
12.
But it's blue and sunny, and as Jennifer said, it's a beautiful day.
Well, if it were 12 degrees, I'd probably be blue too. So, well, it is good to have you both with us today. Recently, I was, a lot of ideas, a lot of topics that we discuss on the show quite often come from conversations on Facebook. And recently, I came across an article that several other directors of Christian education, DCEs, and those working in youth ministry had posted. It was an article from Charisma News, and that doesn't mean that I'm necessarily endorsing that publication or the church body associated with it, but they brought up a good topic. They brought up a really good point. The title of the article was really quite intriguing. The question it raises, youth groups, driving Christian teens to abandon faith is the name of the article. And it raised a question that made me think, well, maybe we need to talk about youth groups during Youth Week on Faith and Family. Yesterday, we talked with our friends from LCMS Youth Ministry and LCMS National Youth Gathering about integrated or intergenerational ministry. And what does that mean? But and we talked about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But and so that means not necessarily throwing out youth groups. But what are youth groups? How have we been doing youth ministry? Now, Jen, you've been a parish DCE for some time now. About 12?
I'm very old.
You've been there for 12 years. You've been at St. John's.
I've been there for 14 years.
14 years.
I've been in ministry. Mm-hmm.
Gosh, we are old.
Very old.
So, Jen, tell us, what is, when it comes to parish youth ministry, what do you see, what is a typical example of youth ministry in a church, in a congregation?
I think the traditional model is that you group teens and or students by their age, and whether it's for educational, social, service-oriented, or any kind of extra activity, they're grouped in their age with their peers. And they might have some parental involvement, like a chaperone or a shepherd, whatever terminology you want to use. And programming is provided for them, whether it's educational, like I said, or activity-based.
So it's
I think the way we've been doing it
It's putting them in age groups for programming,
right.
for activities and programs.
And usually, I mean, they're usually have some kind of educational basis. Mm-hmm. You know, like Sunday school, for example, might be one of those groupings of eight students by age group. And youth ministry, too, also does and generally have some kind of educational component to it.
So quite often when we look at a congregation, we'll see maybe a junior high youth group
exactly.
and a high school youth
high
group.
High school youth group, exactly.
Because the junior high or the middle school students cannot associate with the high school students.
Exactly.
Or the high school students cannot associate with the middle school students.
Exactly.
And then we get to campus ministry, and those college students cannot talk to the high school students. Right, Marcus?
Actually, I used to think that.
I know.
Yeah. I've actually kind of learned, I've been on... You guys are making me feel very, very old. I'm older than both of you. So, but I had been a youth worker before, a non-rostered youth worker before I went to seminary. So I've seen that side of it as Jennifer's discussing. But I've seen kind of an interesting dynamic with in campus ministry. The model was always, you know, hey, they've got to have their own age group, 18 to 22. And to a certain degree, there's a difference between one of my 23 or 24-year-old doctorate students and a freshman.
Mm-hmm.
as they get older, I think those distinctions start to strip away a little bit, and they start to realize that there's something bigger than there's something bigger in the church than just being around young people their own age.
Mm-hmm.
I actually would argue that even if you keep junior and senior high youth group kind of stuff separately, it may be helpful to at least do some events where the older ones are working with the younger ones, even though it doesn't have to be all the time. I know that we try to put on events for high school students to draw them here to our campus ministry so that our college students can get to know them before they even come to school. And so I think as people get older, those distinctions kind of become less important.
Mm-hmm. What's the goal of youth ministry, Jen? As a parish DCE, what do you see as the goal, and what do you think that the common understanding of the purpose of youth ministry is?
Well, I think, I can answer for myself as the DCE at my congregation. I mean, my goal is that I want our teens and our families to grow spiritually, to become transformed. Through God's word, so that they could live their faith in everyday life, so that they become disciples and they carry their faith with them when they leave the nest and do go to college and or the workforce and or create their own families, but that they continue in this faith journey that began in their baptism. And that's where I'm finding that there's some piece that is missing, that we do really great up until high school, but then there's some kind of cliff that my teens are falling off of, my young adults, and they're not coming back.
And that's really the point of the article too, this blog post that we saw, or the article
right.
from Charisma, is, you know, and there've been a number of articles and books that have been published in the last few months and the last few years, really.
Yes,
mostly
it's
in
trend.
Right. It's definitely a trend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In response to some surveys and research that was conducted really from 2004 to 2010 by the Fuller Youth Institute and by the Barna Group, they conducted similar research on the youth as they were in high school, and then one of them followed them through college, and to see where they ended up church-wise and faith-wise through college. They were active in some sort of youth ministry or youth group in high school, and then they followed them through to see how they ended up. And it was pretty crazy, the results. The majority of the youth, by the time they were into college, they were gone. They were no longer connected to a congregation for one reason or another. And it seems that that's the trend that's still persisting, that by the time they get to high school, or, you know, by the time they're done with high school, if they're still involved in their congregation, if they're still attending worship regularly or a Bible study, then in high school, by the time they get to college, the majority of them have disconnected from their congregation, from their church, and there's a very small percentage that stays connected.
Right. I think throughout my ministry, I've seen the trend, because I've been at St. John's for 12 years, so I've seen kids that I've had since they were in elementary school or now have finished college or are in college, and, you know, you see kids as they get older, they become less and less engaged in the life and ministry of the congregation. You know, we always have that joke about confirmation, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see them anymore after confirmation. Well, you know, and then now it's less and less. You see less and less of them as they age, almost aging out of.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in some congregations, it's even before confirmation that they start disappearing.
Yeah.
I know, you know, in college, we had this joke. We had this joke that, you know, if you had church mice, the way to get rid of them is baptize and confirm them, and you'll never see them again.
Right.
It kind of tongue-in-cheek that we go through these rites, and then all of a sudden, then they're gone. Marcus, what are you seeing among college students? Is but not necessarily the active ones who come to you, but the other students that are disconnected from congregations. Are you able to find out about any students who are kind of nominally, you know, do you get hints from parents or pastors saying, hey, a student's coming your way, he hasn't really been involved in the congregation much? How does that work for you as a campus pastor? What's your connection with those somewhat disconnected students?
Well, sometimes those are the kids that are the most connected that I find at the college level. College is a jolt in a lot of ways. It's true, what Jennifer's saying is true, and what you guys have been talking about. I mean, the young people are starting to slip away much earlier, and I would just like to add to that that I think we need to find meaningful ways to help them feel like they're actually a part of the congregation. And I agree with not throwing the baby out with the bathwater with youth groups, and it's about healthy relationships. But one of the most healthiest relationships our young people can have is, you know, during confirmation, you know, okay, hey, you get the acolyte because somebody's got to do it. I mean, if we kind of carry that attitude through, like that's the only thing you ever get to do in church, and now you got to wait till you're 50, kids aren't going to be around. And because everybody wonders, well, where are the young people? Young people are willing to serve if you just ask. And sometimes they think that it's not appropriate for them to get involved, and I think we need to find ways to connect them way earlier so that they don't feel like they're segregated into groups, even though there's things that they might do with people their own age. But yeah, with the kids that are slipping away, I've learned and I think any campus pastor would tell you, you don't write off, you know, the pastor or the DC or somebody's, oh, this young person's coming to your church. They come all the time. They're just going to be a self-starter. And that's the kid that, you know, for all you know, might start slipping away. And then the young person, well, you know, I haven't seen them in 2 years. They come Christmas and Easter. They got family troubles. And next thing you know, that's the young person that needed a fresh start. And so I've learned not to write anybody off and not to assume anything. And I think experience bears it out that you have to be, you know, I'm going after every last one of them to keep them in the faith and to also give them a chance to kind of rekindle their faith.
Well, thanks be to God for shepherds like you who are going after those.
Yeah, it's tough. I lost a girl to Mormonism this year, really? Who was a very faithful young lady. Lost a young man to Islam the year before. And these were people that the pastors or whoever would have said, hey, you know, they're going to come to everything. And they did, and I still lost them. And
wow.
So it's a jolt, and it's a jolt in every direction, and that's why it's so important. But what Jennifer's saying, I mean, they're slipping way earlier because of the influences around them and maybe the loss of healthy relationships, maybe in the family level at
right
home.
And I think for me, that's what struck me the most about this, the article that Andy spoke about at the beginning, was the emphasis on the need to put it back in the hands of parents. I think we've outsourced so much of education, both, you know, public school education, primary education, and our faith education to the church, that parents have lost and neglected this responsibility that they have committed to in the baptism of being the primary faith shapers for their family.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, over the last couple years, this has really kind of come full circle for me. I became a mom 3 years ago, and so now the rubber meets the road. You know, I've been talking about, you know, parental responsibilities and baptism and, you know, family devotions and faith talk with your children. And so now I'm kind of in the trenches now with my congregation, and it really shapes and changes the way you do ministry and the way you think about programming for families.
And we, you know, we can't point fingers solely at parents and say you're not doing your job, because for a long time we as a whole church have adopted this mentality that,
correct,
give your kids to us, we'll teach them about Jesus. You're not the professionals, we are. We'll do this.
Exactly.
And so
we have become enablers in that way, in a lot of ways, and it seems to me we've kind of programmed people to death. Not that there isn't good programming to have, but the programming that we do have, in my experience with the college students, what they really want is someone to talk to. They want to have a relationship with someone. I mean, they forget that I'm 47 years old half the time. they could care less that I'm not their age. They want somebody that actually cares enough to talk to them, and the best place for that to be is in the family.
Mm-hmm. It's probably the sneakers.
At the campus level, I almost become, this sounds weird, I almost, campus ministry, you almost become a surrogate father or mother or a parent or some sort of kind of a custodian for young people, because they don't have their parents around. And so I, you know, the relationship I have with young people at the college level is, yes, as a pastor. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit, because usually they're really freaked out that a pastor gives them the time of day.
Wow.
And because they're like, wow, this is kind of weird. I'm actually spending time with my pastor and having coffee with them up in the student union, and they're normal, or right, mostly normal.
And what a gift. And what a gift that is, especially for the student who, whether or not they want to admit it, they're missing home. You know, they're homesick to some degree. Yes, they're out and enjoying the new freedoms that they have as a college student, but to some degree, probably missing some things that are familiar, missing things about home, family, and those things. What a blessing it is for them to connect with campus ministry, to be able to attend services and receive the gifts of God that are familiar with them. Not only are they receiving the blessings of God and the forgiveness of sins, but also the comfort of something that's familiar.
Well, and that's true. I mean, when Jennifer spends more time with them in junior high and high school, and they're probably, if it's like kids everywhere, they're always, oh, I wish there were more people my age or whatever. Mm-hmm. I see them, and they're sick of seeing people their same age.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when I, we have another church here in town, when I lose, you know, I've got 85% college students, when we have young people that want to go to the other church, the main reason that they cite is simply that they want to see people with gray hair, because they don't, because they miss that. They never would have thought they would have missed that. But I do think there's kind of an intergenerational helpfulness to every stage of everyone's life that is healthy. And I noticed that working with college students, we've got some people here that aren't college students, and they're beloved by the college students just as much as their peers, maybe even more.
Absolutely. And I can remember when Jen and I were students, Jen and I were classmates in the Director of Christian Education Program, and when we were students at Concordia in River Forest, now Concordia, Chicago, I remember on Sunday mornings, you know, attending the congregation that met there on campus, mm-hmm, which was primarily made up of college students. There were a few families, you know, a few families right around the campus neighborhood there that attended. But I remember thinking similarly what you're saying, Marcus. This is different. This is almost a homogenous group. There are no babies crying. Mm-hmm. I missed that. It was kind of funny, you know, being in the parish as a youth and hearing those kids cry and thinking, oh gosh, that's annoying. But it's funny how I missed that when I was meeting in a congregation that was primarily made up of students, and not hearing the babies crying, not hearing the hearing aid of the, you know, one of the older members squealing and that sort of thing. I remember, you know, thinking that, going, gosh, this is quite different than what I remember congregational life to be like. So that's a good point, Marcus, that being in a homogenous group is not necessarily ideal for us, and it's not necessarily what we need either.
Well, at this level, they hang around 18 to 22-year-olds, because that's who's here.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I've just learned to appreciate, I'm thrilled that I have the chance to be a pastor and to spend time, and I think that's the greatest thing that these young people, I mean, I think they learn that more than anything, but most of them are not prepared to spend time with their pastor, because I don't think most pastors spend as much time. I mean, they confirm them spend time. It's a classroom setting. It's you know, and then they move on, and many times pastors aren't as involved in their youth groups. And if a congregation's blessed to have a DC like Jennifer, that's a wonderful thing. But I still think that, you know, the pastoral relationship is an important one.
I agree.
Because at some point, you know, the greatest kudos I can ever get from a young person is when they call me at like 1 o'clock in the morning and hope I'm still up because they really need somebody to talk to, or they're in the middle of some sticky situation. And in many cases, that it might be my work with them, but it might also be the fact that maybe a pastor took the time of day to have coffee with them when they're in 10th grade. And so they felt like, hey, pastors are people you can turn to when you really need them.
And I want to what you're saying is true, and I want to support that. And if any pastors are listening, to say that you do need to be involved, even if you have a paid staff position who works with family and youth, you need to be involved in the life of all your parishioners, because they are sheep in your flock. And I'm very blessed to have two pastors who are very hands-on and involved with all of our family and children. And I think that really sets the stage for the relationships that Christians, as they grow into adult Christians, the relationships they will have with future pastors in congregations that they would attend. And I think it's a valuable relationship to invest in.
The relationship with the pastor in as a child, as a teen, makes a difference. How? What does that provide for a young person to prepare them for later on? Jen?
I think it's about, like Marcus said earlier, about they're like, oh, you're a real person. I can talk to you. You don't just stand in a pulpit and preach. You know, that we see pastors as real people, but as people who care, too, and as people who are concerned with the faith life and development and the faith living of all of their parishioners. And I kind of see it, too, as a modeling, you know, as pastors have relationship with children and teenagers, it's a modeling of future relationships that hopefully they'll have with pastors they will encounter as they grow. So, for example, if, you know, you have a healthy relationship between a teenager and a pastor when they're older and they come into a faith crisis or a life crisis, they know that a pastor is somebody that they can approach and that will care for them and that will offer them spiritual care and will offer them direction. And, you know, the pastors are people who care and who love,
mm-hmm.
you know, all people, instead of this vision or this, you know, whatever society is teaching them and culture is teaching them about the office of the public ministry, you know. So,
Marcus, about a minute before we go to break, your thoughts on why it's important for the pastor to have a meaningful, a healthy relationship with children and teens before they get to that college age?
Young people are looking for authenticity. And it's one thing for them to go to church and to hear the truth of God's word and receive Christ's gifts from the hand of their pastor and the assembled congregation. But they're also wanting to see, hey, do you really believe this? Do you really live this out? Mm. Do you really care about me? I come here, I sit with my parents, I care with that. You were there for confirmation. Are you still going to be there for me when I'm facing things I don't even know what that's going to be? And so I think that kind of a healthy relationship it's just absolutely crucial. I mean, there's fewer things that do go a lot farther in terms of helping me as a campus pastor than pastors having healthy relationships with their young people. And like I said, if a congregation is blessed to have an additional worker in a DCE or somebody working with their youth like Jennifer, that's wonderful. But it just can't be at the expense of all the healthy relationships, whether it's at home with the parents, whether it's with the pastor, whether it's with other people at church. But I really can't emphasize enough how important I think it is to get young people involved in the life of the church.
We're talking with Pastor. We're talking with Campus Pastor Marcus Zill and DCE Jennifer Hills. Stick around. More right here on Faith and Family right after this.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of Inspiration in Action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
The battle in Texas over pro-life legislation continues. A federal activist judge has ruled parts of the law unconstitutional. One is the requirement an abortionist must have hospital admitting privileges within 30 miles. Abortions are routinely botched in America, and if an abortionist is so bad he can't get admitting privileges, women shouldn't trust him with their lives. Officials are trying to avoid patient abandonment when an abortionist sends a woman into the emergency room with zero information on the patient. Precious hours are wasted finding out what's wrong. The other issue is the state's requirement that chemical abortion pill RU-46 be administered by FDA guidelines. These aren't rocket science, but simple common sense protections for women who have abortions.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Worldwide KFUO salutes our day sponsor on this Wednesday, November 6th, 2013. Today's day sponsors are the family of Reverend Leroy Eckert. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to KFUO in honor of Reverend Leroy Eckert, who is celebrating his birthday today. But God demonstrated his own love for us in this, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us, Romans 5:8. Once again, we say thank you to the family of Reverend Leroy Eckert of Red Bud, Illinois.
If you had a valuable piece of fine china, where would you keep it? On the next Focus on the Family, Dr. Walt Lairmore explains that God created women like fine china, delicate and valuable and worth treasuring. He'll share tips from his marriage of over 40 years to Barb on the next Focus on the Family with Jim Daly.
Weekdays at 9:30 on KFUO.
Becoming a worldwide KFUO Day sponsor is easy in the 21st century. First, pick a reason to celebrate, a birthday, an anniversary, or other event, and call me, Mary Schmidt, or Joni Harwell at 1-800-844-0524. For helping support the worldwide outreach of KFUO, you'll receive announcements on KFUO for a special date honoring your day sponsorship. Call us at 1-800-844-0524.
The Supreme Court is weighing the constitutionality of a town council's opening prayers in the Rochester suburb of Greece, New York. Opponents of the prayers got a federal appeals court to declare them unconstitutional. Barry Lynn of Americans United for Separation of Church and State says,
"Our clients felt like they were second-class citizens because they did not agree with the Christian prayer being uttered month after month."
Pastor Pat Medeiros of Greece Assembly of God delivered many of those prayers.
I pray in the name of Jesus, knowing that it's through him that we can come before God's throne room of grace and bring our requests and our petitions.
He came to Washington to hear the case argued.
I like to see the freedom of religious expression preserved in our country, even in public places.
The Supreme Court ruled 30 years ago that prayers before public meetings don't violate the Constitution. Steve Coleman, Washington.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. Good to be with you today. Wednesday, November 6th, we're talking about youth, the life of youth, particularly youth group and transitioning from youth group into adulthood, onto college life and what that means. We're talking with campus pastor Marcus Zill from St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Laramie, Wyoming, and also coordinator of LCMSU, and Jennifer Hills, director of youth and Christian education at St. John Lutheran Church in Alexandria, Virginia. Before we went to break, we were talking about the importance of the relationship between the pastor and the child or youth, the importance of a meaningful relationship. So we've talked about the heart stuff. I want to talk about the head stuff here in just a little bit. Before we do that, though, I want to go to our caller. We've got Cheryl on the line. Cheryl from Indianapolis. Good morning, Cheryl. What's your question?
Hi. I have a question, but first of all, I'm going to say I became a mom 30 years ago and 27 years ago, and a year ago I became a grandmother. And so with my son, I've noticed that he is not involved in the life of the church, even though my grandson was baptized. So how do we define what is the life of the church that we want the youth to be involved in? What do we define the life of the church as?
What do we define the life of the church as, and what do we want the youth to be involved in? Great question. Thank you, Cheryl.
Okay.
Pastor Zill, you want to take a stab at that one first? What do we define?
Well, I would, it's a great question. Thank you for calling, Cheryl. I mean, I think first and foremost, we'd all be remiss if we didn't say that the number one thing is for them to be involved with a gathering assembly of believers on Sunday morning, hearing God's word preached and proclaimed, and receiving the Lord's Supper and all the gifts that God seeks to give us as we gather together. And so obviously the greatest involvement that we can ever have, and sometimes I think we forget, I know I do sometimes as a campus pastor, I get involved in programming and stuff here and there. And I had this revelation when I was about 3 or 4 years into being a campus pastor a decade ago. I was like, you know, man, I can't get people to come to this. I can't get them to come to that, but they sure are coming to church. Now, if I could just get over the hump with all this other programming stuff, and it hit me. It's like, my God, you know, coming to church was a winner. Gathering for evening prayer in the middle of the week was a winner. All these devotional times were a winner. You know, worship was a winner, and everything else, you know, it hit me that that my God, you know, what more involvement? I mean, that's the greatest involvement you can have. And I notice that when students are missing and they feel the sense of community at the college level anyways, that they miss out when they aren't with one another, not only to hear God's word, but the fellowship that binds us together when we're actually gathered together to do that. So I think first and foremost, involvement, and I don't want to, when I mentioned before that we need to get young people involved in terms of things at church, I don't want that to take place of the primary involvement, which is the gathering assembly. I think whenever a young person or an old person or any person who has been involved in the life of the church stops coming to church for 3, 4, 5 weeks, then the church should rightly be concerned, and I don't think we maybe spend enough time reaching out to them to try to make sure that they're missed and that they are still welcome and that we want to find out if there's something that we can do to help them even get to church in some cases. So I think the involvement first and foremost has to be there. Everything else is secondary in my mind beyond just being together to receive Christ's gifts together.
Jen, your thoughts on anything to add to what Pastor Zill said about what it is we want youth to be involved in the life of the church?
I think he hit the nail on the head. The only thing that I would add would be, you know, in God's word, you know, apart from, in addition to, you know, the word that's received in the service, but also, you know, reading their Bibles in a Bible setting, whether it's a private Bible study or whether it's with a group of peers or intergenerational. I would just add that, you know, I am a director of Christian education, so I would
so you got to emphasize the education.
The education component.
And that brings me to the next question. One of the points that the article made that we referred to at the beginning of the article, Youth Groups Driving Christian Teens to Abandon Faith from Charisma News, was the point that according to their article, 55% of American Christians are concerned with modern youth ministry because it's too shallow and too entertainment focused, resulting in an inability to train mature believers. If it's too shallow, if from this survey they think that it's too shallow, what is it that we've talked about the heart stuff. We've talked about having important relationships, meaningful relationships with pastor, with parents, and even, you know, we haven't talked about it much, but yesterday we talked about the importance of having meaningful relationships and mentoring with other members of the congregation,
right,
of all ages. So we get the heart stuff. We got that. What is the knowledge that students need to have to prepare them for what they're going to face in college? What they're going to face, you know, whether they're going to college or off to other places in life, other stations in life. Not everybody goes to college, but, you know, what is it they need to know? What What do they need to learn when it comes to the scriptures, when it comes to faith and doctrine? What do they need to know to be prepared for what they're about to face, especially as a college student, and what their professors are going to be presenting in class, and what their professors are going to be challenging them in class and outside of the classroom, too? What is it they need to know?
I think they need to be equipped with the right tools to answer those questions. I don't necessarily know that there's a knowledge base that, you know, they need to learn A, B, and C. I think they need to know, you know, that the Bible is God's inspired, inerrant, infallible word, and they should turn to that as a source. They should know what the catechism is and how to read it and how to use it. They should know that an LCMS congregation is in their area with their doors open, ready to welcome them and to care for them, that they can go to a pastor or another church worker to receive counseling, and or encouragement. You know, they should know these things about life and what it means to be a disciple. What does that look like? What does that mean?
What does it mean to be an adult, you know, a mature Christian?
Exactly.
Or a maturing Christian, we
might
say.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We're always maturing and always growing until that last day.
Marcus?
If I could add mm-hmm. to that, our young people are bombarded with so many images and influences at such a young age. I always tell people so much of what is helpful to me as campus ministry is stuff that's got to happen when the kids are young to kind of counter that. And I think our young people need to know they need to have as much of I think our catechesis needs to step up at a great level, especially at an early age. Confirmation needs to be seen not just as something for the here and now that we graduate from, but something that we are constantly learning and growing in doctrine. And when young people get to college, they got a lot of tough questions.
When you say catechesis needs to be stepped up, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think we need to go a little bit old school. I think we need to combine, you know, repetition. One of the things that we do here is we're going through the catechism in our evening prayer once a week here on campus. And the young people are like, wow, it's wonderful to hear the catechism when I don't have to memorize it. You know, and they see it as devotionally, and then we start talking about how you can actually use the words that you've learned in the catechism to actually talk about your faith. Our young people are very ill-equipped in general, and it's not any one fault of any one thing, but they're in general not. When I see them in college, they don't know how to share their faith, to talk about their faith, to chatter about their faith. But they know they want to do it, and they know they have some big questions. And so I think we need to not undersell the rigors of, you know, catechetical training from years past. But we also need to combine it with helping young people understand, you know, putting them in positions where they can talk about their faith with others so that they can learn how to view it conversationally so that they're mm-hmm. comfortable sharing their faith with their peers. But yeah, when they show up at college, they got huge questions, and I'll give you one example. We've started. I didn't see this coming, but when the topic of contraception came up the other day, I saw like 20 sets of eyes looking at me, like, "You need to address this, dude. You need to do it now because no one else has ever talked to us about this stuff. Our parents won't talk to us about this stuff. Our pastor back home would talk to us about this stuff. We need some guidance on this stuff, and so don't you dare not address this." And I just offer that as an example of how they are very much hungering for a framework so they can handle this stuff. But you can't wait till, you know, I'm thankful to have 20 young people that want to learn about, you know, how we view, the church views contraceptives and marriage and family planning and all these different types of things. However, you know, there's a lot of young people that really could use this a lot earlier, and it's a sensitive topic, but our young people need us to tackle this stuff, and they need the framework to do it, and the time to give them that framework is when they're younger.
So what I hear you saying is that that our young people, long before they are even thinking about college, need to have a firm foundation in catechesis, in doctrine, so that they, as they continue to grow, as they continue to mature, they're able to articulate what it is they believe, and to help them work through when they have that firm foundation as young, as children, then as they grow and are faced with the questions that the rest of the world is going to throw at them, they're going to be able to think it through. They're going to be able to articulate what they believe and to articulate questions as well when they don't know the answers.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the firmer of a foundation that they have when they show up for college, and they're able to tackle all these issues running and are able to spend their time at college actually talking about their faith, because they already have that foundation as a starting point.
That's all good and noble. How do you do it is the question.
Right.
And
if
I had the perfect answer to it, I'd be quite wealthy probably. But how do you do it? I agree wholeheartedly.
That's the question, Andy. And I think, you know, I'm discovering that it really starts in the home. That if what we say in the church, in confirmation programming, ministry, in Sunday school, in youth group, if that stuff, if those lessons are not taught first in the home, and if parents don't know this stuff and teach this stuff to begin with, then you really don't have a leg to stand on. Christian Smith did this survey through I can't remember the actual...
We're going to talk about it tomorrow, actually.
Are you? Actually? Well, yeah. And, you know, basically the end result is that... So listen in, people. The result is...
You're going to steal all the thunder.
Regardless whether parents do it or not, they are still the number one faith shapers in the life of a child and a teen who then is an adult. So they still have influence, whether or not the kids want to admit it or not and the parents want to admit it or not. They are still the most influential two people or one person that a kid will ever learn about their faith from.
Whether the kid admits it or not, whether the parents admit it or not.
Exactly, exactly. So my job, that, you know, what is my job then as the DCE? You know, my job is to help those parents, help parents bring it back into the home. How can we do that? In a life, in a society that is so overcommitted to everything else and that is so busy and that spends hours and hours just commuting where we live in the national capital area, where it takes, you know, a half an hour to go 10 miles. You know, how do we do this? Those are the questions I want to answer.
And how do we
get parents to shift that mindset that that's your job. I want you to create something flashy and exciting that my kids want to come, and I want to drop them off. I want you to make them faithful and then send them home.
And that's the temptation that parents face. That's the temptation that people who work with youth in the church face is, okay, then we've got to compete with what the world offers.
Right.
And exactly. I know, Marcus, I've heard you speak on this before about youth group is great, but it's not just pizza.
Well, I always say pizza's great, but it's not the gospel.
There you go. That's what it was.
But if I wanted to I wanted to jump in and just add to what Jennifer is saying, which is so true. I mean, our families are so overcommitted, but this gets back to this whole idea about youth group in general that the article raises. There is a hypocrisy factor here for our young people if they see that what happens at home is totally disconnected from what they see when they go to church. And if church quickly becomes just, well, that's just some place that you go, like you go to the doctor, or you go to, if you need to go to Walmart, you need to get something. Because if they go home and it has absolutely no impact on anything, any of the discussions or a devotional life or anything in the life of the family, and everybody just goes home and the kids are playing Xbox or they're watching the latest stupid YouTube addiction is. I mean, if that's what it's like when you go home, I mean, we need to impress upon our parents to turn the darn TV off.
Stop crushing candy on your phone.
45 minutes. If you could, parents, if you're out there listening, if you could even commit to 15 minutes a day in
right.
the evening where nobody does anything except you do a you have a devotion, and we can't assume that our families even know how to do devotions.
Exactly. They're terrified of
But when
concept.
They do, you know what happens?
I was terrified.
When they do it, the next thing they know, it's an hour and a half later, because then the kids brought up something they learned at school, and they almost the devotion ends up becoming a discussion, and there's nothing more wonderful than when mom and dad and Johnny and Susie are sitting around, you know, just talking about how their faith impacts their life because it's being formed by what they've heard mm-hmm. and done together.
And I agree that many parents are probably afraid of the idea of sitting down and doing a devotion, spending time reading the Word together, praying together, might be afraid of that, of having those conversations at home, because they're just not sure where it's going to go, afraid that they're going to fail, or that they're just not going to do something right, or they're going to say something wrong. But even beyond that, it's a matter of setting the time for it. One of the best places, best times to do that is around a family meal.
Mm-hmm.
How many families sit down to dinner together? You got to eat. Everybody's got to eat.
Mm-hmm.
But, so many schedules are so busy in the evening with so many different practices, you know, athletics and practices for that, or for other extracurricular
right.
activities, not just, I'm not blaming sports or anything like that, but as parents, as families, sometimes, all the time, we have to be the ones who set the priorities for our family and what our family schedule is going to be. It's not easy. And I know as a new parent that I'm frightened by the very things that lie ahead and mm-hmm. what our culture poses, all the challenges that it poses. As I watch my nephews who are growing into great teens and all the work that my sister is doing to raise them in the faith, and all the time that they spend running all over the place, I'm just frightened by how hard it is going to be to make sure that our family's schedule reflects our priority of time in the Word.
So maybe it's hard to do a devotion every night, but I think the temptation is then for a family to say, well, you know, we can't get in the habit, so then they just don't do it.
Yeah.
So start simple. Pick one night a week and say, this hour, this half an hour, this is sacred, this is what we do. You know, even though, you know, obviously I disagree with Mormon theology for the, you know, across the board almost,
right.
they do have, I've noticed living in Mormon land, you know, this family home evening.
Right.
They figured it out, right? Mormons and Jewish, too. They figured out how to bring the faith into the home and make it a part of the home life.
And they've been doing it a long time. I remember
as a
school kid, as a high school student, too, you know, hearing my Mormon friends talking about family home evening
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and how important that was. You're right. You've got to set it as a priority
mm-hmm.
in order to be able to do it. It's got to be a commitment.
This is an initiative we started this year with when our Sunday school, our rally day, our kickoff Sunday, is gave all of our parents who have a student in Sunday school a resource. It's a book by a guy named Rich Melheim, you might have heard of.
Oh, yeah.
He has a new book out called The Five Things Your Family Can Do to Grow Stronger, and it's about doing family devotions, how to start family devotions. And so we do ours at bedtime, and I have a soon-to-be 3-year-old and a soon-to-be 2-year-old, and it's crazy. And sometimes we just do it for the ritual, like, we have to do it to do it. We call it our family time. But it's working. Sophie, one time we tried to put Sophie to bed without doing it, and she said, but we need to do family time. And I'm like, oh, yeah, we forgot. And so we pray. We do our highs and lows, our good things of the day and our bad things of the day. We pray. We read a Bible story. And we go to sleep.
Marcus, I appreciate what you say about keeping it simple, because if it becomes too complex, then we're not going
right.
to do it at all.
Oh, absolutely.
I agree. And I think,
what Jennifer's
saying
about the ritual at bedtime, I mean, for her daughter, that's she's going to remember that long throughout her life, that, doggone it, this is what you do when you go to bed, and we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's being formed, and even though it's hectic and there's stuff going on and other things are going, you feel like you don't have as much time as you'd like, you know, even just making sure you do that speaks volumes in terms of the modeling of the faith.
And you know, as I heard a seminary professor once say, you know, why the kid, the child questioning, well, why do we do that? Or, you know, why should I do that? Well, that's what we do because you're a Zill, or you're a Hills, you're a Bates. That's just what Bates family, you know, that's what Bates family members do. And so when they question why we do it, well, that's just what we do. That's who we are, and that's what we do.
This is what our family does.
Right. And you know, Luther, I think, when he gave us a small catechism, and it not just for teaching, but also as the family prayer book, pray in a simple way. When you were talking about keeping it simple, Marcus, that's exactly what he's given us in the small catechism, to pray the Ten Commandments, pray the Creed, pray the Lord's Prayer, all these things that we can do. So simple, you can even do it in the car, on your drive to school, or on your drive home. You know, it's that simple. What a great gift that, you know, our predecessors have given us, that the fathers have given us, that Dr. Luther has given us, to pray this small catechism. And that can start as, you know, as early as kids can start speaking, right?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But what you need to do is to develop a culture where, as a family, we hear God's word together, we read it together, and then as we're able, we find the opportunities to talk about it together. And where that happens, good things are going to happen down the line when young people go to youth group, and also when they show up to college. So that's where the formation's taking place.
So the students that you want to, you obviously want to see all the students when they come to campus ministry. You want to see all the students. What makes it easier for you to connect with them is if they have a firm foundation. What makes it easier for them to make that connection with the congregation there is if they have that firm foundation, is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely.
Jen, any other thoughts from the Parish DCE? I know we've talked about it's important for parents to be connected, for, you know, to have those conversations, and Marcus has reiterated that those conversations in the home are important. Pastors to have a strong relationship and with their youth before they're even thinking about going off to college. Any other thoughts from the parish, and we'll get back to campus ministry here. We've got just about a minute and a half to 2 minutes, about 2 minutes left.
I just want to, you know, make sure that we let parents know that they are equipped to talk to their kids about faith, that God has called, it's a sacred duty that God has given them as the parents, and that He will give them what they need to be the teachers to their children. Just because they don't have a degree and didn't go to seminary, that especially fathers too. You know, I see so many times I see fathers absent in matters of faith with their kids, and I really want to just encourage those dads to take up the mantle and to take this responsibility that has been given to them, this duty to be the shepherds in their home.
Pastor Zill, final thoughts as we wrap up?
Just on the programming side of things, I would love to see a day, you know, when we talked about this this article, that the programming that we do at whatever level is designed to either help focus us back to the family, or at least do programming events that are designed to teach about topics that obviously we can pool our resources better together, rather than taking away from parents the opportunity to actually talk about the very basics of the faith. Things that, you know, questions of matters of science, or things that young people have questions about, that if we can kind of focus our programming where we have programming and where it is necessary on things that we can pull our resources together, I think it will enhance the discussions in the home and support the things that should primarily be taking place there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Both of you, I appreciate your wisdom and your insight today. Jen, thanks so much for spending some time with us. We're talking with Jennifer Hills, Director of Youth and Christian Education at St. John Lutheran Church in Alexandria, Virginia. Jen, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
And Pastor Marcus Zill, Campus Pastor at St. Andrews Lutheran Church in Laramie, Wyoming, and Coordinator for LCMSU, which is the campus ministry organization in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Pastor Zill, thanks for spending some time with us today, giving us great insight and wisdom.
Great to be with you both.
Well, it is time for us to move on, but thank you, and I hope to talk with you all soon. God's blessings in the work that you're doing. We'll talk again soon.
Bye-bye.
Coming up tomorrow on Faith and Family, we'll continue the discussion on youth and youth ministry. So we talk with Pastor Stephen Cholak about the very article that Jen was referring to from Christian Smith, from the research that he did. And we'll also hear what's going on with youth at the Lutherans for Life Conference, the National Lutherans for Life Conference this weekend. Later on this week, we'll also hear about what's going on with the update on Boy Scouts from Pastor Bart Day in the Office of National Mission here at the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Stick around for Moments of Assurance up next, right here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.